Good evening, everyone. You're in the right place at the right time. This is the one and only Coast to Coast AM, blasting out of the Mojave Desert like a Scirocco, blazing across the land, into your town, into your home, slamming into your radio like a supercharged nanoparticle of unobtainium. Greetings from the boldest, bawdiest, most outrageous city in the world, the planetary capital of sun, fun, sin, sex, and secrets. My not-so-humble hometown, Las Vegas, Nevada. My name is George Knapp, your occasional host, your designated driver of the airwaves, and moderator of tonight's upcoming cacophony of conversation. Glad to be back with you once again. You know, we all love our internet, right? We all love the ability to access the knowledge of the whole world, to communicate instantly with people on the other side of the planet, to play games, listen to music. We love shopping and chatting and Facebook and Farmville, and I guess still love MySpace. We love blogs, websites. We love it. We're hooked, spam notwithstanding. And some of us, millions of us, are addicted. It's like crack with a keyboard. It's electronic heroin. A personal computer and the World Wide Web have changed our planet forever, seemingly overnight, in more ways than we can even imagine. But have these wondrous technologies also changed us physically? We have access to more information than ever before, ever in human history, right at our fingertips. But has that made us dumber rather than smarter? A mile wide, but maybe an inch deep? Is it turning our brains into mush? Nicholas Carr says that's exactly what's happening. He's written about it in a compelling new book called The Shallows, and he will be joining me in just a couple of minutes to explain and defend this provocative premise. That's just the starting point, though. For all the changes that we have seen because of computers and the online experience, we haven't seen anything yet. The pace of change has been so dramatic. Soon enough, it's likely to get so dizzying, so fast, that a lot of the world will simply be left behind. And we haven't really prepared for just how radically different our world is going to be, not in the distant future, but very soon. Joining me in the second half of the program tonight is writer Lee Crockett. And wait till you hear his expectations about what lies just ahead for all of us. I think you'll enjoy both of these guests, and I can't wait to talk to them myself. You will recall, those of you who tuned in last Sunday, that I went on a bit of a rant about wild horses. That's a story I've covered on television for a lot of years and occasionally mentioned here on Coast to Coast. What I didn't tell you during that program, because I didn't want to tip anyone off, but is that a few hours after that broadcast ended, I jumped on a helicopter here in Las Vegas, flew up to the site, the area around the latest Roundup project by the government, way up near Elko, hundreds of miles from here in Las Vegas. I was accompanied by a couple of wild horse advocates, including this one lady, Laura Lee, who is suing the BLM to stop the Roundups and to force the government to allow the public to see what's going on these public ranges with public money. We flew over this area that was targeted next by BLM. It wasn't the site of an operation last week when we were there. The reason we didn't fly over the one where the Roundup was underway is that BLM had declared 27,000 acres of public land off limits, including the airspace, off limits to everyone. The two ladies had gone to federal court. They got a federal judge to order BLM to allow them out there, saying that they were but what happened was is that after they go back out to the area, they're followed around. They're followed around, and everywhere they go, they get jacked around by BLM that won't tell them where the operation is. They get warned by sheriff's deputies that if you step onto private property, they'd be arrested. That's because BLM was clever enough to put the horse trap and the corrals on private property. They're in the middle of 500,000 acres of public land, and they declare the public land off limits. And as an extra added insurance, they put the operation on the only private land, or some of the only private land, right in the middle. And the reason for that is they got the owner to say he didn't want any press or public on his property, so they're able to round up the 600 or so horses with no outside scrutiny at all. 21 of those horses died, by the way, both because of injuries suffered while they were running in terror across the desert and from water intoxication. They were allowed to drink their fill after running for miles and miles and after they'd been without a lot of water for days and days. Great job by those BLM horse experts who claim to know more about horses than anyone. Anyway, we flew up on a helicopter, taped a lot of good stuff at this next Roundup site, this area, to prove that the range is in good shape, and so are the horses, far as we could tell, and to document the huge numbers of private cattle that are out there grazing on public lands that we are basically subsidizing. This is the range where BLM is right now. They're grabbing every horse they can find. They have relented a little bit and they allowed some public observers out there this weekend from what I've been told, but again, they found some private land to use as their headquarters, which is just how they operate these days. They put as much of this program on private property as they can as a way to limit how much of it the public gets to see. One other note, the BLM has been ordered to return to federal court by Monday afternoon, tomorrow, to answer about whether it spit in the judge's eye by continuing to limit public access out there. And I sure hope this judge expresses his displeasure with this despicable, underhanded, manipulative, sneaky behavior on the part of a federal agency that is supposed to be accountable to the people who pay their salaries. I'm not holding my breath, though. And later this week, phase three of the roundup will begin, rounding up healthy horses from healthy range, all to meet a magic formula which has little or no relation to reality there on the ground. Once again, hundreds of horses are going to have to go, but 10 times as many cattle will be allowed to stay. Lots of good stuff on the Coast to Coast website tonight, compiled by yours truly and our webmaster, Tim Binall. Just for the sake of whimsy, there's a photo essay about things that are sold in Chinese Walmarts. And that might sound like a joke in search of a punchline, but it's real, and some of it blew me away. Not exactly appetizing. Take a look at it. If you were in charge of the world and you were asked, is it a good time, a good idea to clone a Neanderthal, what would you decide? Is that going too far? Or could science learn plenty by recreating a distant ancient relative of humans? Check the link for that debate. Two UFO stories are mentioned on the NAPS news section. One is a skeptical look at the recent UFO photos from China. Sure looks like someone had some fun with Photoshop on that one. And a case that seems more credible, continued sightings over Fresno, California. From our No Surprise Here department, a Washington Post story about lobbyists for the oil and gas industry. Turns out three-quarters of them either served in Congress or worked for the agencies which supposedly regulate oil and gas. Knocked me over with a feather on that one. And there is a story from India where engineers have designed a laptop computer that will sell for $35. Kind of a fitting story to check out given the focus of tonight's program. Is the internet turning our brains into cream of wheat? We jump right into the thick of that issue with Nick Carr right after this. I'm George Knapp, and this is Coast to Coast. Nicholas Carr is a writer on the social, economic, and business implications of technology. He had a 2008 bestseller called The Big Switch. This new book, The Shallows, What the Internet is Doing to Our Brains, is, I am really enjoying it, and it just about finished it, and boy, it's a mind blower. Nick Carr, thanks for being with us.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
I guess, are the hitmen on the way, the computer industry hitmen on the way to your house?
I get a little nervous sometimes, but I haven't seen any sign of them yet.
Just to start off, and I'm sort of joking, but not really, I want to give the audience a little bit of a framework. I mean, you're not a Luddite, you're not Amish, you're not a computer hater, right?
That's right. In fact, I'm more of a computer fan, or have been throughout much of my life, and certainly not somebody who has run away from technology in any way.
And in the book, you recognize all the tremendous benefits of having the internet, having personal computers?
Absolutely. I know this in my own life very well, not only, you know, from the entertainment value and the communication value, but as a writer, things like Google and the web in general have been a huge help to me in many cases in doing research. So, you know, the reason I'm concerned about the web's effects, the net's effects on our mind, is because it is such a compelling technology that we're using it more and more in various ways. And it's, as a result of that, it is, I think, reshaping our minds in a fairly distinct and fundamental way.
Let's jump into this part of the premise, because I had a lot of advanced emails from people saying, this can't be true. I know so much more stuff. I have access to more knowledge. Your premise, though, is that knowledge or access to more knowledge is not the same thing as being smarter. Make the case.
That's right. I mean, I think throughout most of our history, we've thought about knowledge or thought about intelligence as having two parts. The first part is being able to find relevant information. And the second part, which is at least as important and probably more important, is being able to think deeply about the information we find. What the web is doing, I think, is giving us access to more information than we've ever had access to before, at least making it much easier to find that information, and giving us many other benefits, easy collaboration, easy communication, and so forth. But what it's not doing, in fact, what it's discouraging, I think, is the second part of intelligence, which is being able to go deep, to tune out distractions and interruptions, and think very deeply and with a great deal of attention about the information we've found. And what the web's doing is short-circuiting that aspect of intelligence. And so what we're becoming is kind of perpetually distracted, perpetually interrupted by all this information constantly flowing through our gadgets. And as a result, I fear, we're becoming more superficial thinkers, even as we get all the benefits from the web.
I thought in the book, The Shallows, does a great job of sort of setting the stage for your central premise there in looking at previous technological innovations. Talk about a couple of those, Gutenberg, for example.
Well, even before Gutenberg, I think you can draw a story, and it's a very fascinating story, I think, about how the tools we use to think with, or our ancestors used to think with, have changed the way people think. And I start off by looking at the map. And, you know, that's one of the earliest technologies that we've used to store and transmit information. And I think, and you can read the evidence of very smart people who have looked at the influence of the map on the human mind. And what you see is that, you know, before the map came along, we understood where we were and how we got around purely through our senses, purely through seeing the world as it appeared to our eyes or listening to things with our ears and so forth. The map suddenly gave us a abstract representation of that world. And that gave us many benefits. It helped us get around easier, helped us plot boundaries and so forth. But it also gave our minds a more abstract quality. Suddenly we began to think about the abstract realities or the abstract patterns behind what our senses told us. And it was really a revolution in thinking that came out of that technology. The mechanical clock did something similar with time. It suddenly chopped up what used to be a natural flow into small measurable bits, seconds and minutes and hours. And that ultimately gave us a more scientific mind focused on measurement and so forth. And the two technologies that I look at most closely in the book, one is, of course, the internet. And before that, it's the book, and particularly the book as it became popular in the wake of Gutenberg's invention of the printing press about 550 years ago. And if you think about the book as a technology, it's very interesting. What the book did is it shielded us from distraction. The great thing about a book, about a printed page, is there's nothing else going on. And what the book taught us beyond, you know, the material that you'd read, beyond the novels and the nonfiction and so forth, it taught us how to pay attention, how to tune out distractions, how to read deeply, and also think deeply. If you think about the internet, it's almost the opposite in terms of a technology. It doesn't shield us from distraction the way a printed page does. It inundates us with distractions. And I think, you know, if the printed page, if the Gutenberg book taught us how to pay attention, which is a very rare quality in human history, but a very valuable one, I think, the internet is having the opposite effect. It's not giving us any encouragement or any opportunity to tune out distractions and to read deeply and to think deeply. It is, as I said, keeping us in this perpetual state of distractedness, kind of a very primitive state, if you think about it. You know, back the earliest human ancestors They were perpetually distracted. They constantly shifted their attention, because if you stopped and just focused on one thing for a very long amount of time, you probably got, you know, eaten by a predator or clubbed on the head by the guy in the next cave or something. And so in some ways, the internet brings us back, I think, to a more primitive, but probably also more natural form of thought, in which we're constantly shifting our attention. But what it steals from us are all the benefits that come with actually being able to pay attention to one thing for more than a few minutes at a time.
And is it your idea that books, the ability of humans to concentrate for a long period of time, is sort of a central building block of civilization?
I think it's certainly one of them, and certainly, you know, the building block of Western civilization in recent times. I think you can make an argument, and this is one of the things I try to do in the book, that after the arrival of the book, after the book in the printed page in general became kind of the central technology we used to gain access to information, we saw an explosion of innovation and creativity across science, across literature, across art. And I think much of this came out of not only the fact that books provided us with more information to think about, but they also encouraged us to think deeply about that information. And I think what we know about the brain is that when we pay deep attention, when we really concentrate, that's when we have our deepest thoughts, our most conceptual thoughts, and often our most creative thoughts.
I know you you write a lot about technology. You use the internet, obviously, and the web and personal computers. You're a fan of those things. You recognize the benefits. But at some point, you start getting a gut reaction, I guess, or a gut feeling that something is wrong because you're hearing about it from friends of yours, right?
Well, not only was I hearing about it from friends of mine, but I felt it in my own life. You know, I had been a big, and I continue to be a big user of computers and the internet and online services and digital media and so forth. But a few years ago, I noticed a really troubling change in myself, in my own mind. And that was, I was finding it very hard to concentrate on one thing for more than a few minutes, to really tune out distractions and pay attention. And I noticed it particularly when I'd sit down and try to read a book or to read a long article. You know, I'd get a few paragraphs in or maybe a page or two, and my mind, I realized, started skipping around in just the way it did whenever I'd go online. You know, I wanted to start clicking links. I wanted to check email. I wanted to do some Googling. And so I felt this really, and this was what inspired the book, I felt it in my own life, this kind of dramatic change from the way I'd been used to thinking, which was a mix of, you know, being able to go out and skim and scan and browse, but also having the ability to distance myself from the flow of distractions and really concentrate on one train of thought or one narrative or one argument for a long period of time. And I was, I really felt that I was losing that. And then I began talking to friends and colleagues and other people, and not everyone was having the same experience, but quite a few people told me that they were suffering the same kind of affliction, that they simply couldn't pay attention anymore. And a lot of them did make the connection with their online habits in the way that the net seemed to be training them to constantly shift their attention, to constantly juggle bits of information, multitask, and do all the things that we enjoy doing when we're online. You know, what seemed to be clear to me, and this is the hypothesis I look at in the book, was that this technology that we're using more and more is really changing our habits of mind. And I think ultimately it's having effects even deeper than that on the way our brain cells connect.
I know that I don't know what kind of a writer you are. Me as a journalist, you know, that's the hard part, is writing the story, putting it together. You have to hunker down, force yourself to sit there and write it. I'm sitting at a computer screen, and my mind, the way it works is I will jump at any kind of distraction as a way to get me away from the hard stuff of writing the story. So as I'm sitting writing a piece, 10 different emails come in. I'm happy to go ahead and go and take a sort of a mental break by go checking them out.
Yeah, and you know, that's very a very natural way that we behave. Psychologists have done lots of studies that show that human beings crave new information. And it doesn't matter if the information is trivial or it's important. If we think that there's new information out there and we can get it easily, we'll get it. I mean, particularly if it's the type of stuff we see coming through Facebook or Twitter or email, you know, stuff that is coming from friends or people we know.
Hey, Nick Carr, we're going to take a break right here. That music tells us that a break is coming up. We'll come back, and I want to get into some of the medical studies that you cite in the book to prove the point. Stay with us here, talking about Nick Carr, author of The Shallows, and what the internet is doing to our brains on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome to the machine. In this case, the machine we're talking about is the personal computer. Welcome to the age of the internet. It's already changed our world in so many ways, but is it changing us? When we come back, Nick Carr will make the case that it might be rewiring our brains, and he'll talk about the physical evidence, the studies that have been done to prove that point. Stay with us on Coast to Coast AM. I'm George Knapp. My guest is Nick Carr, author of The Shallows. Nick, you mentioned before the break that you had been hearing about this from some friends, that you felt it in your own life, that something is wrong, that the continued use of the internet had somehow changed your brain. Had you also heard about it from academics? I know you mentioned in the book that teachers, professors, university level were starting to notice changes in their students.
Well, there's been, you know, after I felt this, these changes in myself, my, you know, losing the ability to concentrate and started hearing it from others, I decided to look more into the science behind this, you know, because when you first start thinking about it, it seems like a stretch, you know, can, you know, just looking at a computer screen really change the way our brains work. But in fact, what scientists, brain scientists have found in recent decades is that even the adult brain is constantly adapting to its environment, to its circumstances. And that's a very different different idea of how the brain works than we had even just a few decades ago, when it was assumed that only a child's brain really could change its cellular structure. And what we know now is that the adult brain is constantly changing the way different neurons, our brain cells, connect and through synapses.
One of the phrases you use in the book is that it's massively plastic. What does that mean?
That's a phrase that one neuroscientist used. That means that the adult brain, our brains, are plastic. In other words, they're malleable. They change in response to what we do with our minds. And so, if we practice a certain way of thinking, those cellular connections in our brains get stronger. More neurons are recruited into them. We might even grow additional neurons. But at the same time, if we neglect certain of our mental activities, certain of our mental capabilities, those capabilities begin to weaken. They kind of fall apart as we kind of lose the ability to do what we don't exercise. And I think if you look at what the web's doing, it's training us to take in information in small bits and juggle lots of different tasks simultaneously. And we can hypothesize, and there's some evidence for this, that those kind of neural structures, those neural pathways are strengthening. But at the same time, by preventing us from paying attention, from being contemplative or reflective or introspective, we can also assume that those kind of mental skills are probably weakening, even down at the cellular level.
I was amazed to see some of the statistics you have in the book about how much we use, we're online. I guess it from 2005 to 2009 in North Americans, their average was... it went up to 12 hours a week online. You think it's probably higher than that by now, don't you? Farmville.
I'm sure it is. And you know, one of the things that's driving that up is that we no longer have to sit down at a desk to connect to the net. Many of us now carry smartphones, whether they're iPhones or Blackberries or Droids or whatever. And so we kind of increasingly we carry this technology with us from the moment we wake up, you know, some people have their phones right next to their bed, all the way through the day until we go to bed. And so we're constantly interacting with this technology. And I think that's one of the reasons it's having such a profound effect on our intellectual lives, more so even than things like television, which at least was isolated during our days. You know, we'd use it for entertainment in the evening, but we wouldn't look at it, you know, usually during the workday. With the internet, it's really always with us now, increasingly. So it's always influencing the way we think.
Of course, a lot of these same kinds of arguments and fears were expressed about television, your example there. Is there evidence that television rewired our brains in sort of the same way that the internet does? Not even comparable.
You know, it's almost certain. It would seem almost certain to me that, you know, the television had some effect on our intellectual lives and on our brains, simply because we spend so much time watching it. And in fact, statistics show we watch even though we're spending so much time online, we still watch television more than ever before. But television, you know, as I said, was limited usually to an entertainment function, whereas the web can serve up information in any form, not just sounds, not just pictures, not just moving pictures, but text. For the first time, written words can be broadcast through this new medium, so you no longer have to go to a book or a magazine or a newspaper to read. And because the web is so flexible as a technology, and frankly, that's one of its great strengths, we are using it increasingly to find information in all forms. And so it's kind of the way it presents information, which is often in a very jumbled state, where you're juggling lots of different bits of small bits of information, that increasingly is becoming our default way of gathering information and making sense of information in all forms.
I want to talk about some of the medical studies. You mentioned one by a guy named Jacob Nielsen that was conducted in 2006, where he had these 232 people put a small camera that tracked their eye movements. Tell me what he was trying to prove there and what he did prove.
Yeah, he was studying how do people read, or how do they look at web pages when they come across written words, text on web pages. And so he outfitted, as you said, the bunch of people with little cameras that tracked their eye movements. And what he found was that there's a particular pattern that people, in the way people move their eyes when they look at a web page, and it's the letter F. So what you do is you glance across an entire line toward the top of the page, and maybe a line or two, and then your eye kind of drifts down the left side of the page and then maybe goes halfway across a couple of more lines and then kind of just drifts down a little further down the page on the left side. And so what he found was that, you know, when we're reading, quote unquote, online, we're actually not doing that much reading. We're skimming words in this F pattern, and really only reading a small percentage of the words we come across. So even though we talk about reading online and reading in books or print as if they were the same thing, in fact, we read very differently when we go onto our computers and go onto the internet than when we sit down with a printed page.
This guy said that they reported that most web pages are viewed for like 10 seconds or less, and fewer than 1 in 10 viewed go beyond 2 minutes.
Right, and even some of those that go beyond 2 minutes, they believe that a lot of that is because people go away from their computer or they just leave the web page open behind other things, other windows that they're working on. So, you know, it's pretty clear that when we go online, our major behavior is to jump very quickly from piece of information or from page of information to the next page. And very rarely do we slow down and read deeply or take in information in a kind of calm or attentive manner.
One of the other studies, a lady named Zhu, I don't even know if it's a he or a she, Erping Zhu,
yeah,
where they had these two different groups of students, I guess, or two different groups of people.
Yeah.
And what was that study?
Well, that was This is a very fascinating study. What this woman did is she got two groups of people, or actually she got a bunch of people, and she had them read the same piece of writing online. And all she did was vary the number of links in the piece of writing. So just the number of words that were highlighted as hyperlinks. And what she found was that as the number of links increased, reading comprehension declined. And that happened whether or not people clicked on the links or not. And so, in other words, you know, when we go online, we know that there are all these links and we love to click on them, and each one is a kind of distraction that can take us away to a new piece of information. But what she found was just having those links there, just having those highlighted or underlined words, is a distraction even if you don't click on them. Because what happens is your brain, and particularly the decision-making parts of your brain, have to activate very briefly to say, gee, oh, here's a link. Is this something I should click on or not? And each one of those little distractions undermines, in a small but measurable way, our reading comprehension. Because anytime you're distracted in the act of reading, you comprehend a little less than if you were really paying deep attention.
One of the parts that you look at is you talk about sort of the depth of our intelligence, how it hinges on the ability to transfer information from working memory to long-term memory. It's sort of like a backlog there, or a clogged line. Explain how that comes into it.
Well, there are two very different kinds of memory in our brains. There's one that's a very short-term store, which scientists call working memory, and that's basically where we gather information very quickly, moment by moment. It's basically our conscious understanding of the world, second to second. And then there's long-term memory, which is where kind of our deep knowledge is embedded, and, you know, where we remember things for long periods of time, and where we make the connections between different ideas or facts that give our understanding and our knowledge depth and kind of conceptual rigor. The problem is that our short-term working memory has a very, very small capacity. It can only hold, you know, 2 or 3 or 4 bits of information at a time. And what you need to do in order to move that information from working memory to long-term memory is you have to pay attention to it. If you don't pay attention, it never makes the journey to long-term memory. It just disappears from your mind very, very quickly. And what we know is that it's very easy to have what scientists call cognitive overload, where too much information is coming into your working memory, and so nothing sticks. It's all just coming in and going out very, very quickly, and nothing, you don't attend to anything long enough to really move it over into long-term memory and weave it into your knowledge, your conceptual knowledge of the world. And this seems to be what the web does as a technology, because it bombards our short-term working memory with little bits of information coming at us all the time. We never are able to move information to long-term memory and weave it into the deep knowledge that really gives richness and distinctiveness, I think, to our thoughts and to our intellectual lives.
The argument has been made, but hey, wait a second. IQ tests show that we're getting smarter. They keep going up, and they have gone up ever since the end of World War II, and I guess they're trying to extrapolate that as somehow computers are part of that.
It's true that that people's IQ scores, pretty much for the last century, have been going up at a fairly steady pace, something like 3% every decade. But it's important to dig down into those numbers, because IQ tests measure different kinds of intelligence, and it turns out that all of the gains that we've seen in IQ over this long period have tended to be in the areas of our visual skills and our ability to, particularly our ability to sense abstract patterns in visual information. So, you know, if you remember kind of IQ tests, there are parts of them where you have to kind of mentally rotate little figures in your mind in order to figure out what they're going to look like from different angles and stuff. And we're certainly getting better at doing that type of thing. But at the same time, we're not getting better at you know, our basic knowledge, basic arithmetic. We're certainly not getting better at verbal skills. In fact, measurements of our ability, our reading comprehension ability, and our ability to express ourselves in words have been going down pretty steadily, particularly in recent decades. So it's a mixed picture when you look at intelligence. And it's very hard, I think, and it's very much a stretch to say, oh, well, the internet is making us smarter because IQ scores are going up. IQ scores have been going up since way before the internet, and they seem to be going up because of some basic change in society, basically a bigger stress on abstract reasoning, on these visual skills of manipulating figures in space. And these things, it's true that the internet might continue to help us do these types of things. But at the same time, and there's a very interesting study that was published in the magazine Science last year, those new skills, those kind of skills in our visual intelligence, seem to come at the expense of deeper thinking skills. So critical thinking, conceptual thinking, even things like empathy may in fact be going down even as these other aspects of intelligence go up.
There are those who would say, you know, so what? So what that people don't know as much? They don't memorize like they used to. So what? They have the computer in front of them. They can look anything up. They don't need to be deep thinkers. They can let the computer do it for them.
Well, there's some truth to that. I mean, I don't deny that having access, you know, at the tip of our fingers and on the screens we carry with us all the time to all sorts of facts and all sorts of other bits of information is extremely valuable. But if we think that you can outsource memory, as some people like to say, that you don't have to remember anything anymore because you can just look it up in an instant with Google, you're missing the fact that, in fact, much of the richness of our thoughts comes from the connections we make within our own mind, the connections between things we entrust to our memory, and in particular to our long-term memory. And what's interesting is, you know, sometimes you hear this argument that, oh, we don't have to remember stuff anymore because it's all online. So that frees up parts of our brain to do, you know, deeper processing or to become more intelligent. But that's a complete misreading of how the brain works. In fact, if you look at studies, the more that we have in our memory, in our personal memory, the richer our thinking becomes. We learn more, we become smarter. And so it's very dangerous to assume that, oh, because we have easy access to information, we don't have to memorize or remember anything anymore. That is a recipe for really a more superficial kind of thinking. Our memory, in particular our long-term memory, is really the seat of understanding, and particularly the seat of kind of a distinctive intelligence. And if we don't develop that, we are, I think, fated to become you know, people who have constant access to information, but ultimately are shallower in the way we think about that information.
Give me some practical possibilities then, in a practical sense, what that means to the world, how that could come into play if in fact, 20 years from now, we all are much more shallow in our thinking.
Yeah. Well, I mean, in one of the big things that I stress in the book is that a lot of our culture is built on people having the ability to pay attention. So great works of literature, great works of art, a lot of the greatest conceptual thinking in science all comes from people who have been able to tune out distractions and think in a solitary way in many cases. And that doesn't take anything away from the need to be social and to juggle lots of information in other times in our lives. But I think purely at a cultural level, we stand to lose a great deal of the richness of our culture if we're no longer able to pay attention. At a more practical level, there are also indications that creativity and innovativeness often hinge on the ability to pay attention, and that people who are multitasking all the time, particularly multitasking using screens and computers and in the online world, may never have the type of creative breakthroughs that you get when you pay deep attention.
Talking with Nick Carr, author of The Shallows. When we come back, I want to get into the evil that is Google. And don't sue me, Google folks. I'm just kidding, sort of. As well as additional ramifications from use of the Internet. Stay with us here on Coast to Coast AM.